Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast of Engelsberg Ideas, where we take ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, who's Deputy Editor at EI. And this week, EI Talks, the problem with classical music. Now, why do otherwise cultured, civilized people with a huge interest in the arts have such an issue with this greatest of Western cultural achievements? A genre, a form that's given us figures of undoubted, and some would say unrivaled genius. Beethoven, Mozart, Bach, Wagner, and so much else beside. Now, Alistair, we too, although we got into classical music in very different ways, don't appear to have this problem. So maybe we might illuminate by talking about the way we did get into classical music. So you first, what was your journey into classical music?
But my first memory of classical music is the bits in Beatles albums where George Martin, the producer, who was trained in a kind of classical background, actually had never done sort of rock or popular music until he started with the Beatles producing.
Well, he was a comedy producer, wasn't he?
Exactly. In Eleanor Rigby, there's a string quartet. Yeah, yeah. In the album Revolver, where there's the use of the horn, the French horn. And I've got this very clear memory of sort of when I was about 8 or 9 years old, hearing this sort of music and my dad saying, you know, that's the influence of George Martin, who was classically trained. I'd already been playing the piano since I was about 4 or 5 years old, because I was sort of started quite early on it, but I probably hadn't got that kind of musical ear yet.
Yeah.
But from there, everything flowed. I remember just having this huge reverence for what the classical tradition is, simply because those bits of Beatles albums were, to me, the sort of best bits of all. Eleanor Rigby is still my favourite Beatles song, partly because of that kind of melding of something of greater antiquity with something which is so contemporary and about city life and is you know, immediately kind of relatable.
Yeah, and I'm with you on Eleanor Rigby. I really do think it's an extraordinary achievement. I've even compared it before with, you know, the works of Schubert. It's a work of utter genius. But you're right. Part of what makes it special is the real way in which it embraces classical forms.
Exactly, and I think it was just part of my life. You know, I played the piano from a young age. I played the cello from about the age of 8. And I was in the school choir and did singing and sang a lot as well. And, you know, I was introduced to it through my father, who also plays the piano and the cello. And to me, classical music growing up, you know, listening to the Brandenburg Concertos by Bach on the radio in the car, or Radio 3, playing the Guessing the Composer game with my family, that was all a lot more real to me than the kind of bands that my peers were listening to. I genuinely didn't really know who James Blunt was, or the Arctic Monkeys, or whatever. And it all seemed kind of unreal. But that's because I was, you know, at home and through the stuff I was playing, completely immersed in classical music, kind of whether I knew it or not. It's not like I thought, oh, I'm playing something which is, you know, classical. It was just the music that was all around me. And that gives you, I think, a great base with which to go on and listen to everything else. It gives you that musicality, that musical ear, which allows you to appreciate whatever, Bob Dylan, Arctic Monkeys, whoever, you know, everything is connected.
Well, I'm afraid I don't have such a base. I came from a very different way. I'm obviously much older than you, Alistair, sadly. And I came to classical music rather in the way that Wagner composed his Ring Cycle. In other words, as is famously known, Wagner wrote his Ring Cycle backwards and composed it forwards. And I came to classical music in a backwards kind of way, in the fact that around about the late 1970s, early 1980s, mid-1980s, something like that, there was a whole load of fortuitous things that came together. One was an interest in electronic music that was really becoming a force at that point, both in terms of white sort of pop rock music, whatever you think, but also black music as well, that had embraced the likes of Kraftwerk and people like that and the kind of electronic techniques there. And so I became interested in some of the people that had influenced them that came under this very capacious banner of classical music, people like Morton Subotnick. I think people like Morton Feldman were also talked about that way. I don't know why they're all called Morton, but there you go, unusual. And, of course, at the same time, Pierre Boulez was quite an important figure who was pushing radical music, Second Viennese School, people like Schoenberg and Webern and other stuff, very, very eclectic stuff, as well as composing his own music. And I think the first thing, certainly one of the first records I ever bought, was a record of a classical music, was a recording of Boulez's Plis Sinon Plis, fold after fold. It was on the Erato label. And I remember it very, very distinctively because its fourth side, it was a double LP, was completely blank, which was most odd. But I was fortunate because I was in the West Midlands at the time, and Simon Rattle has emerged as this rather romantic figure leading the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. And I was on this backwards journey, so went from this electronic stuff to the Second Viennese School, as I've said, then to Stravinsky and Debussy, going on this backwards way. Debussy and Stravinsky, interesting, because they were contemporaries of novelists I was reading, of filmmakers I was watching, of art that I was looking at. So it was all part of this high modernist world that was very, very exciting, particularly if you came from the industrial West Midlands. And then realised through listening to Rattle and the CBSO, through Mahler and backwards, that there was this real classical tradition that began supposedly with Haydn through the First Viennese School of Beethoven and Mozart and Schubert, and then up to Brahms and everything else, and all the other stuff that came on there. And then just threw myself into it and was helped because it was a pretty active cultural sphere at the time. And of course, Radio 3 was crucial to it. And as you say, there was always two crucial Radio 3 programs that are really good for anyone who really wants to engage with classical music. One of those is Building a Library, of course, where people sort through recordings and you learn an awful lot there, although I wish it was still done by just one person rather than the conversation they have now. And secondly, Composer of the Week, which is a really brilliant program which looks at both the life, the times, and the music, and contextualizes everything. And my goodness, you learn a lot from that. So why do you think, given all that, given our experiences, very different but open to this stuff, people have such a problem with it?
Well, I think it's because people are actually saturated by what we call classical music. It's all around us in adverts, on aeroplanes, on, you know, on tannoys, in and actually some of the kind of musical programs on the radio reflect that. Things like Classic FM don't necessarily distinguish music by concerts. They tend to put playlists on of music that is sort of lush or romantic, and you can kind of bathe in the sonic bath of musicness. So it's not that people aren't listening to classical music, and indeed in film scores, which I think is where most people enjoy classical music now, they are in fact listening to recycled classical music. I mean, sometimes I think that almost all film scores are just recycled bits of Shostakovich symphonies. And, you know, I mean, another example, Lord of the Rings is clearly, the theme tune is clearly a riff on Dvorak's, a bit of Dvorak's New World Symphony. Yep. You know, the list is endless. You know, in The Shining, you know, you can see the influence of the avant-garde, you know, all that. So it's not that people don't listen to aren't hearing classical music all around them and don't find it kind of relatable or listen to things like Hans Zimmer or whatever. But it's potentially that this idea of an ear which must be cultivated through a long process of engagement, which is potentially a difficult process and has pitfalls and can sometimes leave you feeling a bit alienated and not and unsure. You know, for God's sake, first time I listened to Schoenberg, I wondered, you know, whether, well, what's the point of this? This is completely insane. But then slowly over time, you listen to more, you start developing a kind of appreciation, a kind of, again, a kind of musicality. And I think that is a very countercultural thing to embark on nowadays. It's not something we generally, we really want things to be immediately very accessible. And the idea that something should take a bit of effort and should take time is to many people almost offensive, I think. Yeah. It's seen as elitist. It's seen as not something that's, you know, is, again, it's not accessible for everyone. And yet, to me, it is the most accessible thing because it's a process that is intrinsically accessible. It's something you can do off Amazon Music, Spotify, whatever, you know, if you have the time. Or concerts are cheap, you know. You can go and see some of the finest classical repertoire played by musicians of astonishing skill for less than a tenner in London. You know, it's not like this stuff is not accessible, actually. Even compared to sports matches. Sports matches are insanely expensive, you know, for what they are.
As is pop music.
Exactly.
And I think that those charges of an elitism that constantly surround this, the idea that it's difficult, I suppose also as well because the core of the repertoire is white, it's male, it's European. It's a great man culture, or at least that's the way it's perceived. That's obviously problematic at a time when we have this culture war, and there's an element of this culture war, I think, to what Arts Council England have done in their controversial attempt to move English National Opera out of London. Their appalling acts in removing funding from the Britain Sinfonia, which was the only real outlet for classical music in the whole of the east of England. Their attitude towards the Leeds Lieder Festival, for example, is really quite shocking. And when you look at these things, you tend to think, well, the money here is not a great deal of money. There must be something more to this than economics. And I think it's a culture war that's being waged by a certain kind of art bureaucrat. And let's face it, is there any surprise that Nick Sirota's involved in this? This seems to be an act against what is perceived as elitist, what is perceived as hierarchical, what is perceived as European in this kind of age of a kind of manic demotic that we are living through at the moment, and particularly the malign cultural influence of much of American culture. But I also want to look at some of the other things here. And this idea that I think for Anglophone speakers that somehow this culture is less accessible because it involves the issue of foreign language often as well. And this is particularly true in opera, obviously, despite the success of great British operas like Peter Grimes, and in fact the fantastic success that English National Opera has had, ironically, with its work. Although, of course, Akhenaten, which is by an Anglophone composer, is written in a series of ancient languages and yet sold out its entire run at the English National Opera. It's a huge success. And that was a great achievement, I think.
Yeah, I think there is a sense... I was in, I'm going to sound sort of ridiculously cosmopolitan here. I went to a concert in Berlin in March and was in Paris a couple of weekends ago for another concert. And in Berlin, it was various pieces of early English music, so Purcell and Byrd, set to interpretive dance, which sounds awful, but I assure you it was actually really brilliant. In Paris, again, actually even more profound experience. I saw Les Arts Florissants, which is a group devoted to early music run by William Christie. It was a memorial concert for Geneviève de Chambourg, who was an impresario of early music, a great collector of Renaissance instruments in France and had one of the biggest collections of early music instruments in Europe. And what do I mean by that? It's the viol, it's those kind of big recorders, it's... the stuff that has got, you know, was kind of thrown away after we consolidated music into a set number of instruments and standardized the size of various stringed instruments. And she was a great collector, and she gave up her collection to a figures like Jordi Savall and William Christie to practice on sort of back in the day. And that's how they partly how they became very gifted and interested in this kind of genre. Now, early music is interesting because if we're going to talk about a way of breaking down that kind of great man European tradition, going back actually before the kind of Austro-German thing that most people, most people call the classical tradition, i.e., beginning with Bach, going through Mozart, Beethoven, and you know, ending up with Brahms and Liszt and so on. You know, early music is actually very demotic, full of madrigals, which people would have sung for, you know, in secular contexts. Yeah. It's got
dance
a huge
as well, folk dance, tunes,
which is why this concert in Berlin, which I've not described very well, but it's exactly why it was quite interesting, because you've got modern dance being married to very, very old music. And, you know, you've got that sense of, movement and rhythm, which actually completes the early music.
And a modern engagement with the past as well. That brings us to a question about, which is often raised, about the setting in which classical music is performed. That people say it's intimidating, for example, that one sits in silence. One has to know the right place to applaud, which is always, I mean, of no concern to anyone, although I do appreciate the fact that silence is there. I'd expect that in a theatre or a cinema. So I don't think classical music is particularly different in that. But it's always had, and I think this is particularly true of opera, and as you say, early music, a social element to it that's very, very important, not just in the playing of music. The string quartet, for example, is born of the idea of the social, of an engagement, a conversation with people, but also the format. I mean, what do you think can be done in terms of the format to perhaps make it more engaging, less intimidating, if it is intimidating?
Well, give a specific example. I went to see Handel's Alcina at Glyndebourne last year, and I was thinking during the performance, you know, it was very enjoyable. I like Handel. Alcina is for people who haven't seen it, a kind of mad Tempest style opera where, you know, there's a magic box and there's wizards and witches, and it's all, the plot is kind of completely crazy. Yeah, and the music, there's one great sort of aria in it, but most of the music is pretty sort of, you know, feels like Handel kind of did it pretty quickly.
It's,
but
the recycled reason why, Handel.
Exactly, but the reason why it's like that is because it probably wouldn't have been performed in a darkened room kind of Wagnerian silence with this awesome reverence for the music, because the music is, it was probably have been accompanied by people having dinner and drinking and chatting away, and then people would have tuned in to the aria they all like. Yeah. And I think that's something that would help, is we don't need to have reverence for the classical tradition simply because it's a tradition and it's there. We have reverence for it because of the contact we make with it and with the way that it changes people, and it's certainly changed my life, and it's changed your life, Paul, and it's something that has touched me in so many different ways. And to me, it's very sad that people don't go on that kind of journey. And I think losing that reverence is actually a good way to start, because then you can start deconstructing, you know, the kind of, as you say, the kind of slightly priggish approach to music. I mean, I find the kind of on the clapping thing, just if you're worried about it, just clap when everyone else does, or don't clap, or whatever, or go and, you know, look at the ceiling.
It's rather like not standing up during the Hallelujah chorus, which often baffles people who've never seen that before. But, I mean, we've seen lots of experiments in terms of the way in this. I mean, I think the Birmingham Opera Company with Graham Vick was particularly innovative this in taking operas into industrial landscapes and the most unusual places, messing around with people, moving crowds around so that they were almost part of the opera itself. And you've seen this fantastic stuff that's done by Grindbourne, which takes place in Dulce and in Hackney, every summer. In fact, they're even doing their own ring cycle. I mean, amazingly. They're using innovative stuff as well. And I've seen real innovation over just the last week with the fantastic Longborough ring cycle that climaxed with its Götterdämmerung. This is in a tiny 400-seater theatre, converted cattle shed with the old seating from the refurbished Royal Opera House. I mean, it's just the most wonderful thing, which is entirely private. It's never made a loss. It gets great support from people and has a conductor of genius, I think, a Wagnerian of genius in Anthony Negus. So I think there's lots and lots of ways in which this can be done. But I always think the most important thing about this is getting people through the door in the first place. And I dread to think how much money I've spent taking people, opera virgins, classical virgins, to their first concert or their first opera. And not once has one of them said, no, I don't like that. It transforms people and they become addicted to it. In fact, I took a couple of friends for the first time to the recent Glyndebourne Don Giovanni, and they absolutely loved everything. When can we go again, they say. And this is almost always the response that people have to it. I think they like the social nature of it. Obviously, you know, okay, Glyndebourne's not your average one. But I think they also like the idea of the engagement with it, this tremendously physical genre where you see people, you know, just... It, one of the most remarkable things about classical music, particularly opera, is it's unmediated. Anything can go wrong. It hardly ever does because these people are so skillful, so engaged, so extraordinarily brave to do what they do. But it's the physicality of opera that I love in particular, and I'm sure that's true of you. But on a personal note, one of the great accounts of opera appears in Julian Barnes's great work, Levels of Life, which is his meditation on the death of his wife, the agent, Pat Kavanagh. And he talks about the period when she's dying, when she knows she's dying, when she has died. And he talks about the fact that he ends up only going to see opera, because in those circumstances, he calls opera his social realism, because it has stripped everything down to what his life has become stripped down, and that is just love and death. And of course, that was the title of a rather brilliant history of opera as well, Love and Death, because it really does bear it down. And I think that's what I find extraordinary about opera in particular, is the way that everything is stripped bare ultimately, particularly in those great arias or a great scene between Wotan and Brunhilde or something, where the conversation between them or the relationship between them is so stripped down to the basics of humanity. And that's what appeals to me. But the key is to get people through the door to experience those kind of emotions, those kind of passions, that kind of beauty. So let me put you on the spot, Alistair. You've got three pieces of music. You can take someone, a friend, anyone, to a classical music concert or an opera. You've got three pieces of music. What would they be?
Well, my first one would be Benjamin Britten's Sea Interludes, which is just not very long. It's something like 40 minutes. And they are wonderful pieces of music. And if you're from the UK, we're a people who are surrounded by the sea, you know, on a kind of banal level. But, you know, listening to that, it's very intimate music, and, you know, I really challenge anyone who's ever seen the sea from the English coast on a kind of dim morning not to be moved by that music and for it to describe very, very particularly that experience. But it's also a great intro to music because maybe later on in life you might go and see Peter Grimes.
Yeah.
And that's the music, and we've the orchestral spoiled. Music within Peter Grimes.
And we've been spoiled with productions of Peter Grimes in recent years as well. I mean, yeah. British directors in particular have really stood up. And you know, the last production there at the Royal Opera House with Alan Clayton as Peter Grimes was spectacularly good.
But opera is a good example, I mean, of what is possible in classical music. You know, for a long time, people thought there would never be a great British opera that sprung from a kind of British composer. You know, and Britain came along and produced Peter Grimes, and it was a huge... It was also a social thing, talk about social aspects of music. That was so popular after the war, partly because people had been starved of music, and it became such a big sort of cultural thing. I think partly because people just wanted to come back into the concert hall.
I know there's a whole repertoire of modern British operas that are masterpieces, whether it's Harrison Birtwistle, whether it's Thomas Addis, and I think in particular, as far as I'm concerned, George Benjamin's work.
Mm. But yeah, Love and Death, I think in music, I mean, the second piece, I'm going to cheat a bit, but I'd say either Bach's The Well-Tempered Clavier or the Barcello Suites. Barcello Suites, again, interesting, were basically lost to music for a very long time. They weren't really performed very much. They had to be rediscovered by great cellists like Casals in the late 19th century. And what you do when you listen... I mean, I played a lot of the Well-Tempered Clavier on the piano, and I played some of the cello suites on the cello. And I can tell you that playing those things, I mean, is even at a pretty low level, getting to a kind of competence with them is there's everything in those pieces of music that then exists in the history of music. It's all already there.
Yeah.
You know, in the Well-Tempered Clavier, which are sort of series of almost exercises for the piano, you get, the Tristan chord, vivid romanticism, you get everything. And I would implore someone to just, even if they're at home, sit with some decent headphones and listen to whoever, maybe someone like Daniel Barenboim playing the Well-Tempered Clavier, that is a kind of interpretation of the music that's not necessarily someone trying to make it exactly how Bach sounded or doing it on the harpsichord, something that's a bit kind of accessible to the ear. And just sit there for 2 hours, because it'll be you live whole lifetimes in music. I feel that the times I played music to a level where I was satisfied with the performance, I lived, it's like those 10 minutes, 15 minute periods were bigger than my entire life. And that is a great consolation in life, to have that memory that you were larger than just this individual.
I'm very envious when I watch opera singers, and I just think, my God, I wish I could do that. I wish I could experience what you're doing now.
You know, it's all the lives you haven't lived as well, and that's where life is to an extent. And you get that through music, and of course you get it in contemporary music and rock music and all the rest, but there is something really majestic, actually.
So what's your third choice?
My third choice is probably just like one of the big bangers of a symphony, which, if we're talking about particularly Western music, symphonies are the apex of music as, again, sonic architecture.
The cathedral.
It's the cathedral. I mean, it's, well, actually, someone once described the Barcello Suites as a cathedral, and each bar is a little alcove within the broader construction, which is an appealing metaphor. But yeah, I would listen to, one of the Beethoven symphonies, or, the Eroica Symphony, or Shostakovich 7, the Leningrad Symphony, and that's what music can do, because it's, in a way, it's in the language of forms, it's about a relationship between notes, it's a universal language, if you like. Has there ever been a piece of music that has expressed defiance like the Leningrad Symphony in the terms that are just so immediately accessible? You listen to that, you don't need to know the story about Shostakovich being holed up during the Siege of Leningrad and composing it, and then it being beamed out over from speakers around the city, and then being transported across to America as this kind of propaganda aspect to the war. You don't need to know all that story. But knowing it makes the experience even richer.
Yeah,
no, and it's the same with Beethoven, the Eroica Symphony. Mm. Think about the atmosphere in Europe at the time, the political ructions, the terror of Napoleon, and it all becomes much richer over time as you listen to it. So, but all of that music, all those I've cheated a bit, all those five, four pieces of music, if you like, no, five pieces of music are a good start.
Well, let me stick to three. Let me try and stick to three. First one, you mentioned how many people get into classical music through film music. And in fact, one of the first pieces of classical music I really loved, was Bartok's Music for Strings, Percussion and Celesta, which is, you know, Bartok was pretty much sui generis. He has this fantastic, unique sonic sound world that does lend itself to the soundtrack, which is obviously what Stanley Kubrick realised, because he used it as the soundtrack to The Shining. And of course, Kubrick was particularly brilliant at using classical music. One thinks of Ligeti and Strauss in 2001: A Space Odyssey, and then he was there in Barry Lyndon as well. I mean, he's fantastic at employing that, using music that's not written for the cinema, but works as cinematic music. So Bartok's Music for Strings, Percussion and Celesta, in fact, anything by Bartok is fantastic. I think it's really important to see chamber music, to see particularly the string quartet, when one sees the relationship between those four instruments, the two violins, the viola and the cello, and the way in which they also produce a kind of architecture. Perhaps this is more the parish church, but it gets cathedral-like in something like Beethoven's Opus 131, his string quartet number 14, which I think is the supreme masterpiece of the chamber music repertoire. So I'd recommend anyone to listen to that, and particularly to go to a concert where that is performed, because it's only when you see the relationship between those four brilliant players that you really understand the architecture. And I think that's true of seeing a symphony as well. And then when it comes to a choral work, well, let me cheat again. I'll have four as well. If it's Lieder, great German song cycles, it has to be Winterreise. And again, it's best if you see it, so that you see that dynamic, you see the story unfold, the narrative. If it's opera, well, and I'm thinking here of First Time, This Is Just About Joy, Verdi's La Traviata would be my choice. And if you've got the stamina, follow it up with Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. Nothing really beats a De Ponte opera, which is exceptionally funny, but also incredibly moving in terms of the story itself, and literally revolutionary. So what I would suggest, and I'm sure you'd agree with this, is don't be intimidated by classical music. Throw yourself in. You will swim, though you may drown in ecstasy. So thank you, Alistair, for that, and I hope we've enthused you. So go out there, get the recordings, and buy the tickets. There's classical music. There's no problem with it.